All right, everyone, it's time to get started. Welcome to From Vanity to Value, Metrics That Matter. My name's Stephen Borg. You can see my email here and Twitter handle. Feel free to write anytime. Some housekeeping. We're talking about metrics. And one of the metrics, a really important metric for speakers at TechEd, is the evaluation. It lets the people at TechEd that are running it determine where we should go in the future for topics and for speakers. So if you would, as part of my metric, fill out your evaluation. Now, this is a talk just before lunch. That's a pretty dangerous time to talk. So just on the off chance that someone gets hungry, I was able to stop by the speaker lounge and steal a whole lot of bars. So, if you need one of them, just raise your hand. I'll throw one out to you. There you go. First bar. All right. Let's start with some really bad metrics. Metrics drive people's behaviors. And here's some bad metrics. Not catching your flight home. If you happen to be in the United States, you might have heard one airline pulled away from the gate to make an on-time departure and then sat on the tarmac for 7 hours before pulling back in. So the U.S. government imposed a rule that said if you pull away from the tarmac and you don't fly within, it's an hour and a half, you're fined a very large amount per passenger. Makes sense. Wanted to change the behavior of the airlines. But what they found was that the day after that policy went into effect, the cancellations of airline flights jumped over 50%. Because no one wants to pull away from the gate on the off chance they can't take off and face one of those fines, which was $2,000 to $3,000 per passenger. Hard hiking trips. In the former Soviet Union, manufacturers of hiking gear, camping gear, were measured on their tons of output. So, when you went hiking, you would end up with cast iron skillets, big, very heavy pieces of camping equipment, because it's very easy to make several tons of camping equipment if you make it heavy. Yes? Yeah, okay, that's true. You buy it once and you use it for generations. It's that sturdy. Losing your phone connection to customer service. This is another famous one or popular one. Amazon suffered this for a while. They provided metrics on who, basically you got bonuses based on how many times you answered the phone to help a customer. So they had a lot of disconnects. You'd talk on the phone, it was difficult. If you hung up, they would call back, and you'd get another one, right? Two calls, one problem. Or somebody else might get it. But they found a very large number of disconnects with their service. Gateway learned that lesson and said, we will not do that. Instead, we will put a policy in place that says you must solve the customer's problem on their first call. And by the way, if you spend more than 17 minutes with any customer, you are not eligible for a bonus that week. So you can see where this comes. If I'm someone at Gateway, you call me and I say, yes, you have a problem? Yes, my computer doesn't work. Have you plugged it in? Yes. Sorry, return it. We'll send you a new one. And what happened was their return rate went up 700%. That evidently did not drive them into bankruptcy, but other similar things did. And they're no longer with us. So metrics drive people's behavior in good and in bad ways. Here's today's outline. We'll talk about why metrics. I'm going through a blazing fast overview of a giant list of metrics. We'll talk about what makes a good metric. We're going to have a very, very, very brief introduction to Kanban and Scrum, one slide each. And then we're going to talk about the metrics that Scrum and Kanban use and why they tend to be different than traditional metrics. I'll make an assertion that there's one metric that you should be paying attention to. And we'll do a case study. I love this quote from Russell Ackoff. Managers who don't know how to measure what they want settle for wanting what they can measure. This is way too true. So it's very difficult to measure some things and very easy to measure others. So you find you provide a measurement for the metric that's easy to measure, and that's what managers start wanting and changing the behavior for. There was a phone, sorry about that, if you want to take that one picture. And then what you see is all there is. That's another problem. People don't see some of the underlying measures that they should, and they watch only what they can. I'm going to give you one example before we start, which is utilization versus productivity, or capacity versus flow. It's very easy to measure when you walk by someone's desk, do they have Visual Studio up and are they typing code? Real easy to measure. If they're sitting back looking at the ceiling, is that bad? Is that good? I would argue that you can't make faster programmers by sending them to typing school. That looking at the ceiling is probably an important piece as well. This was a lean conference I was at. And notice how packed tight everything is. They wanted to maximize the number of speakers and the slots so that their attendees got the most value from the conference. But notice the title of the first one. Keynote, Fundamental Secrets of the Universe. That's going to go long. And it did go long. And it pushed into every other one throughout the day and led to massive dissatisfaction. Jamming stuff in is probably not necessarily a good idea. This is not an effective autobahn or freeway, but it is 100% utilized. Exactly. There's no extra room here. But let's be honest. You all have met a project manager who does the equivalent of, no, wait, we could fit a motorcycle in here. Right? You've met that project manager. Instead, we want to measure how effectively people are being used. And Jim Benson has a quote that I like, and I'll let you read. But we want to measure what gets done, not trying to jam stuff in. This is just one example of a metric. This is an example of my calendar. It's basically just prior to me moving to a personal Kanban. But you'll notice I have calls with customers, and they all have a gap between. Because if I'm talking to a customer, and it's going well, and I'm making a sale, I don't want to say, okay, goodbye, and hang up, and pick up another call to call somebody else. So there's a gap. Does it mean it's wasted time? Absolutely not. I might build a statement of work in there. I might do something else. And then I have card time, which was just the president of the company, Lori Borg, and the office manager, Amanda, at Northwest Cadence. They gave me a stack of cards, and I would just pull the top one off, do it, put a line through it, drop it on Amanda's desk, pick up the next one. They could reprioritize it at any moment rather than scheduling things. So leaving things open lets you get more done. Just another quote. I was doing an assessment of a company, and they mentioned that their organization is structured to get 100% utilization, not 100% productivity. which is interesting. Productivity is hard to measure. Utilization is not. So let's take a look at this giant list of metrics. And when we go see these metrics, we're not going to spend very much time on them. Some are good, some are bad. Most are good in certain cases, bad in other cases. But these are common metrics used. Bugs per 1,000 lines of code. MTTR, mean time to repair. Number of system crashes and hangs. Defect severity. Average reported defects in working day. You probably have these kind of metrics. How many bugs are being reported? How many are we closing? That's a very common defect style metric. If we look at project metrics, we'll find things like schedule estimation accuracy. This one drives me crazy. When you come from an agile world, how well you estimated your schedule is probably not important. If you give me a project schedule for a project that lasts 1 year, and you hit it exactly, exactly perfectly, every single task took exactly the right amount of time, a year later, you have 100% schedule estimation accuracy. And I would argue that you have failed. Because if you've been developing software for a year, and you learned nothing that required a change, that would be surprising. Very, very surprising. Utilization rate, percent overtime. Here's some code metrics that are common. Complexity, we measure cyclomatic complexity. Code coverage of unit tests. A lot of these are very good metrics at time, other times bad. And here's one of my favorites. Number of undiscovered bugs released to production. How do you measure that? Everybody laughs, support calls, but how? Yeah. You measure it afterwards. That could very well be. But you can measure it before you go to production. I'm just going to mention this one briefly. If you want to measure how many fish are in a lake, there's a couple ways to do it. One is to take dynamite and throw it in the lake and count all the fish that float to the surface. But you probably don't do that. Instead, you catch 1,000 fish, tag them, throw them back into the lake, wait a week, catch another 1,000 fish, and measure the percentage. If 1,000 fish that you caught the second time all have tags, there's probably only 1,000 fish in the lake. But if you caught, out of that 1,000, 100 that have tags, you have somewhere around 10,000, give or take a lot. If you are a large software development company like Microsoft, you have multiple layers of testing. If that testing is independent, you can look at how many bugs that were discovered in the independent trials, correlate them to find out how many overlap there was, and make a determination of how many bugs are actually out there released to production. Has anyone filed a bug on Microsoft Connect? A few. That's another way that they can tell how many bugs are in their product that haven't yet been caught. I'm just throwing that out there. There are things you can measure that you don't think you can measure. Here's some more. Customer metrics. Customer problem calls per month. There's process metrics. What's our bug density during the testing phase, et cetera. Again, just a giant list of metrics. But there's a characteristic of metrics that makes them effective in your context. Not all metrics are effective all the time. They need to be in your context. And here's a few characteristics. They are comparable. In other words, if I'm measuring the same thing twice, I should be able to compare the values. Not necessarily across teams, but I should be able to compare them somewhere. your sprint teams. They're delivering a velocity at every sprint. I should be able to compare that velocity over time. Yeah, it's not going to be a perfect correlation, but they need to be comparable. If they're completely random, they're not good. They need to be simple. If you're going to use metrics in your organization to drive change, if they're a complicated metric, people don't know how to change their behavior to maximize the metric. So if you give them something that requires them to know calculus in order for them to understand how the metric is calculated, they won't know how to change their behavior. Metrics need to be simple if they're going to be effective. They need to be actionable. Now, this applies to just one class of metrics, the metrics you use for process improvement. Some metrics aren't necessarily actionable right now, but you collect them behind the scenes. For instance, I talked with Tomas before the presentation, and his organization measures developer mood or happiness with a Nico Nico board, right? There's a smiley face, a frowny face, and a something in between face. And when you leave work that day, you just put a sticker underneath whatever one you felt that day. Now, that metric is not necessarily actionable right then. And it's not meant to drive changes in behavior. It's used to then later correlate, when people were happy, what were we doing? And when people were sad, what were we doing? So that's a metric you might gather that's not actionable now, but that might be actionable in the future. But you should, if you're driving change, have an actionable metric that people can respond to. And the last is, it has to be honest. And this one is hard. Because as soon as you provide a metric and start measuring people, you know what happens, right? The metric might be continually going up, but the benefit to the business goes up, stalls, and maybe even declines as people start to game the metric. This is an example of a really horrible one. This, if you do lines of code, if I have these three lines of code, am I three times as productive? No. Lines of code is a terrible metric for productivity, but we have to watch out for honesty. Now, I'm going to start to define something that I think is very, very important, because in order for a metric to be honest over time, you might have to change what you're actually measuring. And there are two types of metrics. There's the true metric. That's what you should measure. And there's a proxy metric for that metric, which is what you can measure. I want to measure how happy are the customers with my product. That's hard to measure. So I send a survey, and I get survey results back. Or I look at how many help desk calls that I have and correlate that with dissatisfaction. It's very hard for me to measure exactly how happy people are. Maybe I have a Nico Nico board for my application, right? When they close it, it pops up a little thing. How happy were you with the app today? Who knows? But that would still be a proxy metric. So we have to be cautious of what we're using when it's a proxy metric. I see this in companies all the time. They want social engagement. Social engagement. We want to engage with the community through Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. But if you're measuring the number of Facebook likes you have, and that becomes your metric, that's a proxy metric for your engagement. But it's real easy to buy Facebook likes. And getting a lot of liked Facebook buys that aren't real does not really engage you with your audience any better. But the metric keeps going up. So we have to be cautious in that case. So let's look at a few before we get to lean metrics. We have the quality metrics, defect removal efficiency. That's how effective are we at removing defects before going to before shipping. That's not very simple. Code coverage, not always honest. Usually it is, but I can build a unit test, and if I auto-generate a unit test, What's the default behavior of a unit test? It's passing, right? So I get code coverage without actually doing any validation. Performance profiling, not always actionable. Sometimes it is. Sizing metrics, lines of code, not always honest. We talked about that one. Story points are interesting, rarely comparable across teams. So if you're running a Scrum organization, not a team, but many, many teams in your organization, it's very difficult to compare story points across your teams. And there's a reason for that. Teams learn to approximate their effort by their own story point generation. So if you say, we're going to take that and stamp it so that everybody across the entire org uses the exact same story points, well, then you might as well be measuring in days, because all of a sudden, the teams aren't getting there on their own and understanding their domain and having a common language. Some productivity metrics. I put one here that I think is really important. Quality. According to Capers-Jones, he's a luminary in the software metrics business. He's studied over 25,000 software projects. And the number one metric associated with productivity and the ability to deliver value is quality. This is not what we are told, right? We're told there's the iron triangle, you know, scope, resources, and time. And then if you have to maintain all that, we could just sacrifice quality and get it out the door fast. That's true for one sprint or one release. Not true for very long. If you start to deliver poor quality, what happens is you get a bad feedback cycle where you get failure demand in the form of bugs. Now you're spending more of your time working on bugs, working on refactors, than you are delivering value. Quality, if you want to deliver fast over time, the number one thing you can do is deliver at high quality. That's at a study of more than 25,000 software projects, and it's consistently the number one metric. To deliver fast, build high quality. Okay, I'm not going to beat that drum anymore, but well, one last note. It's so correlated that it's a proxy for productivity. You can look at a company's quality and know how fast they ship. User metrics, user satisfaction, number of help desk calls, these are all other metrics that you can measure that are sometimes difficult. Business metrics, we talked about schedule estimation accuracy. ROI, return on investment. How many of your organizations measure ROI? Do you measure it before or after you start work? Before. Do you ever measure it after? Nobody does. It's crazy. The business prioritizes based on expected ROI, but never comes back and sees, did we actually get that ROI? It's a horrible way to prioritize your features if you never know if it's just going to the best liar or whether it's actual ROI. Okay, this talk is about Scrum and Kanban metrics specifically. I wanted to show all of those because it's important to frame how big the metric space is and how often people go to giant lists of metrics, when in reality, we need very few. First, an introduction. What is Scrum? How many people here use Scrum? Awesome. How many people use Kanban? How many people use Scrumban? Kind of a combination. A few. Okay. Here's Scrum, again, blazing fast. We start here with a product backlog, bunch of features we want to build. We pull off a small subset of features that we can deliver in a sprint, 1 to 4 weeks, generally with a preference towards shorter sprints. We do some daily reporting back to the team or reporting is the wrong word, but talking back to the team. And then at the end of the sprint, we deliver a subset of working software. So in other words, we're building things in very small increments. We might have a giant backlog, but we deliver it in small increments. And at the end of that delivery, the software is of shippable quality. You may not ship it, but it's of high quality. You don't wait to test it. It's tested code. Kanban is another very popular way to deliver software. Instead of sprints, you have a continuous flow. It has a few basics. You visualize your work. You make policies explicit so people know how to flow the work. You limit how much work you're doing. So in other words, I can't have more than 3 items in development. No one's going to call me on my Kanban board? What's wrong with my Kanban board? What's that? Don't have a defect log and ready potentially? I'm going to call out dev and test are 2 different columns. Put those together if you can. You might not be able to start, but try to get those together as fast as you can, developer and tester together. We'll talk about that in a moment. In Kanban, we focus on flowing through the system as quickly as possible, and we commit to a continuous improvement program. So that's it. Here's Scrum. We start on day 1, we get to the last day, everything kind of moves over, and we reset the board. In Kanban, the board never changes. Things just keep flowing across it. A continuous versus iterative approach. Here's a couple other differences between the two, just to kind of ground you on what Kanban is. Kanban's a simpler process methodology in general. So here are the metrics for Kanban and Scrum, and I want to talk about why they're different. Any questions, by the way, on Kanban or Scrum? Okay. Here are the metrics for Scrum. There are 2 metrics that Scrum says you must measure generally. And those 2 are velocity and burndown. That's it. You might measure some other things. Work capacity, you might measure accuracy of task estimation, you might measure a whole bunch of other things, but the 2 things you measure are velocity and burndown. Here are the metrics for Kanban. Again, you don't measure much. You measure what your work in process is, and you measure how much time it takes for something to get through the system, whatever you're defining the system. And there are other things that you can measure. But in Kanban, you measure very few metrics. In Scrum, very few metrics. Why? What's the difference? When you're in an agile development shop, feedback is king. It trumps everything else. We want fast software delivery so that we can get feedback as to whether we're delivering the right thing, whether we're on track with the customer, whether we're on track with our budget, whether it's still worth it to build the software. And interestingly, the Agile movement was a response to a software development paradigm that focused on technical risk. Steve McConnell reported on a very interesting study, and I'm a little suspicious of the data because the numbers work out perfectly, but when he looked at where the marketplace risk is for applications, if you're building software and selling it, the actual risk profile is 90% of your risk comes from the market, that you're delivering the wrong thing. Only 10% of your actual risk comes from the iron triangle. Are we delivering the scope required, in the time required, with the budget required? We spend a lot of time on the technical risk, but the vast majority of the risk is in the market risk. What's interesting is that in that same study, he found that the resources spent by organizations to manage risk, 90% of the money went to managing technical risk. You have project managers upon project managers reporting on this and reporting on that. When in reality, the risk is in the market, but we're only spending 10% on getting feedback from customers, doing interviews, showing mock-ups and prototypes. Agile shifts that paradigm. It puts the customer front and center, goes to very fast feedback cycles, and focuses on market risk versus technical risk. That's one of the main distinctions, and it's why we don't have as many metrics in Agile. Because most of the metrics I showed you all target technical risk. Very few target market risk. We want very, very fast feedback so we can attack the right risk for our organization. Now, you may say, yes, but I build internal software for our own company. I'd argue that the same thing stands. Your customers would rather get good solutions for their problems quickly than perfect solutions over a long, long period of time. That's why Lean and Agile metrics are very simple, because we're attacking a different problem. Now, I'm going to make an assertion here, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, that there's one true metric to rule them all, the one thing everyone should be measuring. Now, I don't believe that you only should measure this one, but I think this one is very, very important in an agile and a lean environment, and that's time to feedback. It's the one measure I'm going to ask you to take away. How fast can you get feedback from your various activities? And we'll talk about that and more in just a moment. But first, let's talk about feedback loops. We want to be able to measure something and then adjust our behavior, remeasure, adjust in a very, very fast cycle. If you throw in any current time delay, you all of a sudden slow your responsiveness. You've all been naked in a hotel room somewhere, waiting for the shower to get just the right temperature, right? So you're standing there, you reach over, you turn on the shower, it's too cold. This happens to me. I jump over and I turn it up, still too cold, little hotter, the water's still too cold, turn it up a lot, just right. And you hop in, and you start, and then yikes, and you're right back out, because it's too hot, right? There was a long lag in the feedback cycle. And it's miserable. Why? Because there was a lot of whip, water in pipes, right? So you had a slow cycle time to get through. And you waste water, you waste time, you have low quality because your expectations or your feelings of the hotel are diminished. It's just all bad. There's nothing good that comes out of that delay. And yet we expect that and accept it in software development somehow. That it's okay to build code and not test it for 2 weeks or 2 months. And we focus sometimes on the wrong things. So let's talk about feedback and that cycle time piece. I did a quick look at the conference and the schedule, and where do people focus most of their efforts in talks, et cetera? It's right here on this run. So in any step, you queue up for whatever process, you do some setup work, you do the work, you then wait for something, and then you move on. And we focus in software development on the run piece. What can we do to help our developers code faster? What can we do to help our testers test faster? And yet, if you look at the overall time that people spend inside of a development process, a requirement might come into a queue, sit in the queue for weeks before a developer picks it up, works on it, makes sure it works, checks it in, gets, you know, confirmation that it's working, and then moves on to the next requirement. Meanwhile, that same requirement goes into another queue just like this, where the tester leaves it in a queue for a long period of time, gets to the setup stage, tests it, files a bug, which goes back into another queue. If you had to guess, how much time is spent actually working on a requirement versus that requirement sitting in a queue waiting to be worked on? Is it 5% of the time that you touch it? 50% of the time? 10%? 80? 80%. Awesome. 80% in the working on time? Oh, in the queue. 20% in the touch. Okay, 80% in the queue. 20% in touch time. 10%. 30%. Do I hear 40? 40. Anybody 40? When you look at relatively high performing scrum teams, the touch time versus the lead time is approximately 5%. 5% of the time it's being worked on. If you're in a traditional waterfall, it's well below 1%. There's a lot of room for improvement on delivering quickly. It just boggles my mind. I get to see hundreds of software development teams and look at their metrics and go through and kind of dig these things out. And it's absolutely fascinating how little amount of time is spent working on things as opposed to them waiting. Here's some problems with slow feedback. I mean, there's just a ton, but just a few. They really introduce a lot more work into the system. If you've got a long time between code and bug fix, it's really hard for a developer. If you're a developer and you write some code and you get a bug on that code a month later, when you open up and look at that code, you pretty much think that an idiot wrote the code. It's so long ago that you don't even remember it. You've learned new things. It was poorly architected. It's hard to get back into the mental state to fix it. In fact, Microsoft did an interesting study of their developers, and if they spent longer than 2 weeks away from the code to the bug fix, it took them 2 hours to just get to understanding where the code was before they could start working on the code. 2 hours in this setup phase just to start to be mentally ready to fix the code. And the fix may only be 20 minutes, but they're taking that massive amount of time to do it. It's also hard for the tester. If you test a piece of code and it goes back to the developer and the developer doesn't fix it for 2 weeks, when the tester gets it back, they're looking at the test case and they don't have the context again. It's the same experience. Now you've just doubled that pain. It lowers overall productivity. You tend to build the wrong thing. You tend to have the business equivalent of a shower that isn't responsive. And it really drags down the development teams. You know what? Before we move on, let me give one example. There's a company I worked with in Tennessee in the United States, and I thought it was really interesting. I was showing them Visual Studio's testing tools, MTM, and how it would gather a bunch of data when you filed bugs behind the scenes, and they smiled politely and said, yeah, that's really cool, but we're not going to use it. I'm like, well, if it's cool, why not use it? Well, our testers are only allowed one bug. Really? What do you mean, allowed one bug? Well, if a tester finds a bug, they have to stop looking for bugs until that bug is fixed and checked in. That absolutely, insanely shocked me. They literally move over to a developer, sit down with the developer and say, here's the bug, I'm preempting you, I'll show you the bug, we'll fix it together and we'll check in the fix. I'll verify it and check it in. That's insane. From a utilization perspective, right? You're wasting tester time. What if the developer's gone? They go and they do test automation. They don't look for bugs until you come back. Now, if you're on vacation or you just got married or something like that, then you know they'll find another developer. But they still only get one bug. And what's interesting is I said, well, let me look at your bug backlog. And they were a little shy because it had 6 items in it. I'm just saying. Interestingly, they're working on in the same organization as a group in Silicon Valley, which has a backlog of hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of bugs, because they work totally differently. Their testers are independent from their developers. And the team that only has 1 bug per tester is dramatically and demonstrably faster than the team in San Francisco, by a long shot, more than twice as productive. Now, am I saying you should go back and take that idea back? Maybe not. Depends on your context. They build medical devices. Quality is extremely important. But they deliver faster as well. OK, let's go through some warnings. I told you the metric to measure is time to feedback. But let's start with this. Recall that there are true metrics and proxy metrics. Time to feedback is what you really want to measure, but it's difficult. And there's something called Goodhart's Law that says when a metric becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. So in other words, if you start to measure people's productivity on how many hours they're sitting in their seat at the office, you're going to get bad behavior. If you are measuring people on anything, and they get compensated for it especially, their behavior will shift, and generally it's going to cease to be a good business measure. So I want that as our caveat as we go into some of these metrics that you might choose to measure for time to feedback. Code coverage. Unit test code coverage can be a proxy for time to feedback. Why? Because when I make a change to the code, within seconds, I get notified whether or not I broke something else in the application. It may be a good measure for you. It may not. Is it comparable? Is it actionable? Is it honest? Etc. Mean time to customer feedback. How fast, when you put something on the board, when an executive at your company has an idea, how fast can you go to a customer and say, is this a good plan? Will you buy it? How fast can you do that? That might mean that you move to mock-ups, that you move to throwaway code that just kind of gets an idea of what you need to build. How fast can you get time to feedback? Now, be careful. Goodhart's Law, once it becomes a measure, once you're measuring people on it, then they might stupidly spend resources to get feedback when it's not appropriate. But it's a good one to think about. I like this one, MTTR, mean time to realize, recover, repair, and remediate. We're moving to a different world. How many of you have been to an Azure session of any nature? Okay, in Azure, in AWS, you tend to run services, not products. So if you're shipping a product, you care very, very deeply about mean time to failure. If someone installs something locally and they have a bug, it's very, very hard to fix it. So you care how long they can use it before they run into a bug. Mean time to failure is paramount. When you move to the cloud and you're moving at services speed, it doesn't really matter if it fails. What matters is how fast you can recover from that failure. So if you're in a services mindset and you're building for the cloud or building where you can update things quickly, then you care about things like how fast till I realize there's a problem. Things like application insights, if you've seen it. How fast can I recover from the problem? In other words, how fast can I just like chop off that machine and do something so that people don't experience the problem? Then how fast can I repair the problem, fix the actual code or the configuration that caused the problem? And then how fast can I remediate the problem, which is understand the root cause and put structures in place so that root cause does not occur again? We're looking at multiple different time scales. Realize is measured in milliseconds to minutes. Recover is measured in minutes to hours. Repair is hours to days, and remediate is probably days to months in that time frame. But we're looking at how fast you can get through those things. So those are proxy metrics for time to feedback. Here's some tools you can use. Experiments. That's trying something really easy, really fast, to get it in front of the customer. I won't use their names. Well, I'll use one of the company's names, but not the other. There was a company that ran an experiment, and they manufactured printers. And they were the low-end printer manufacturer. And they wanted to build business-style printers. So they went out to their customers who had these high-end Hewlett-Packard printers, the really nice Hewlett-Packard printers, and they said, would you come in and test out our new competitive printer? And all they did was they took the Hewlett-Packard printer, ripped off the cover, and put their cover on it. Right? And the people came in and used their printer for several hours, and their feedback was, it's really good, but it's not anywhere near as good as the Hewlett-Packard. Nowhere close. It doesn't print as fast, the quality's lower, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because they had a brand perception. They ran an experiment, realized that they probably should not throw a lot of money into that market unless they were willing to do a massive push into the market. They learned something very, very rapidly. A/B testing, two forms of your website. When you're talking to customers, do we use the term application lifecycle management or do we use the term DevOps? There's a lot of similarities between the two. What gets people most excited? Prototypes and pretotypes. There's a whole movement in San Francisco on pretotyping, which I think is interesting. That's like not even a prototype. It's just nothing. A guy built this great app. Here was the intent. You'd whip out your cell phone. You'd take a picture of the food you were about to eat. It would run some complex analysis, figure out the healthiness of the food, and at the end of the day, send you a ranking. Did you eat healthily that day? He estimated that it was about $2 to $3 million to build the back-end artificial intelligence for the processing. How did he test it? He spent a week building an app, put the app out there, and hired a whole bunch of college students to look at the food, look at a table, enter it in the computer manually. Hugely successful. People downloaded it like crazy. But nobody paid for it when it came time to pay for it, and nobody used it after about the first week. He spent $200,000 and saved spending several million to reach that failure. Building something just enough to get feedback is pretty important. Cross-functional teams are another great way to get feedback. Put your developers and your testers together nice and tight. And that's an excellent way to get feedback. What I don't have here is automatic build, continuous integration, continuous delivery to production. Those are fantastic ways to get it as well. I'm gonna have two soapboxes or rants or something here. There's two things that I think are important. If you don't have an automated build that runs tests and deploys at least to a test environment, you need to focus on that. You need to focus on an automated build process that at code check-in or every night or something compiles the code, deploys it, and runs one test. One test. Can it hit the website? I don't care. One test. You have to get to that level of automation. It's like a magic pill. It changes the behavior of teams. If you're trying to get agile, you have to have something to support that, and that automated build process is one of those things. The second thing, I mentioned it earlier, devs and testers need to be on the same team. I don't care if they're different skill sets. I don't care if one's a manual tester and doesn't know a Visual Basic from Python or anything. I don't care. They need to be sitting together in the same team, in the same geographical region, preferably in the same office side by side. That's another thing that's like a magic pill. Yes? Yes, so there's talk of what if someone has the skills of a developer and a QA in one person, a cross-functional person, if you would, rather than a cross-functional team. That's valuable in a lot of ways. Not necessarily realistic for an entire organization. Those people are hard to hire. Developers tend to be highly optimistic people. Oh yeah, I'll build that in 2 days. 2 months later, the first thing goes to testing. Testers, on the other hand, tend to be really good at entering completely unexpected data and breaking things in ways the developer never thought of. And to get both of those skill sets into one person is very difficult. That said, if you look at what Microsoft is doing today, they used to have SDETs and SDEs. SDET was Software Development Engineer in Test. And then they had SDEs, which is a Software Development Engineer. Now, you'd think that would be close enough, right? They're both Software Development Engineers, but one's in Test. No. They're getting rid of those designations, and everybody's becoming a Software Engineer, an SE. Why? Because the SDETs reported up a different channel than the SDEs. And once you have two different bosses, even if you happen to be sitting together, it makes promotions confusing. It makes sets classes up between them. Well, I'm a developer, you're just a tester, or vice versa. Right? So good question, very good question. Any others, by the way? Yes. Ah, that's a wonderful question. It's the second derivative, right? The question is, now I'm getting feedback. How do I get feedback on my feedback? How do I know that my feedback cycle is continuing to work, that I'm measuring the right thing? That's a very hard question. One I won't answer directly, but I'll show you some tools to measure various things. Yes, the definition of efficiency, constantly wanting to become more efficient. I'm going to just challenge the word efficient, because it's such a big word that can mean a lot of things. And most of the time when people say efficient, they mean utilized. Everyone's sitting in their seats 8 hours a day. Not always, but because they can measure it, that's what they often call it. All right, let's move to a thought exercise. How can we get faster feedback? And I'm going to talk about it at a general level. This could be at the unit test level, really, really fast, the code writing. It could be at building new products in the organization. Or more likely, it can be your user stories that you're delivering or your features you're delivering. And to do that, I'm going to use a tool called the cumulative flow diagram. And if you take a look at the vertical axis, it's the amount of work in whatever measure you have. The number of user stories, for example. Across the x-axis, we have time moving forward. Now, if you start off a brand new team, you don't have any work and you've just started, and then gradually you're going to get more and more and more and more and more work assigned to your team over time. And meanwhile, you're going to be working on that, and you're going to complete some work over time here. So at this time, we've now completed some work. So we have three states for our work. We have the work in process, which is what we're actually working on at a given time. And up here, we have the backlog of stuff along this line, or nothing up here, to do. And over here, we have done. Fair enough? With the cumulative flow diagram, you can measure your work in process. If you have nice straight lines like this, which a lot of organizations surprisingly do, I did not believe it until I started writing software that gathers metrics from TFS, and all of a sudden I'm seeing that that is surprisingly well correlated. They're not very linear, they're very bumpy, but they don't vary too much the work in process doesn't get gigantic. So if you have work in process at this moment in time, you can then measure your average lead time. Once you start work here, how often or how long will it take on average till you can get feedback? Fair? Till it's done and you can go get feedback from that. Let's make an assumption. We've got six items here: features, user stories, tasks, products, whatever. And we make an executive decision to limit WIP. Tomas, I'm going to use your example of your company. Your executive comes in and says, Tomas, your team is working on six items. I want you to work on three. If you ever work on four, you're fired. Okay? An executive makes this decision to limit the number of features that Tomas's team can work on. What does that do? It means that this line can never be bigger than three. What does that do to your average lead time? Fairly dramatic reduction in the time it takes to get feedback. If you want to get feedback faster, work on less. That doesn't mean, as a team of 12, we used to work on six items. Now six people go on vacation and we work on three. Right? No, we all work together to deliver those three items faster. To deliver value more frequently and to get feedback faster, reduce your work in process. I'm going to give you 2 minutes of math now. Any math majors in here? People who work with math? Just a couple. My background is math. So I'm going to do 2 minutes of math, but it's simple math. This is called Little's Law. And we have these two things. We have our work in process, we have our average lead time, and we have our delivery rate. Right? Delivery rate equals the work in progress divided by the lead time, implies that the lead time is equal to work in progress divided by the delivery rate. All that's mathematical mumbo jumbo to mean this important thing. The amount of work in process you have is a leading metric for lead time. Almost all the metrics we use in software development are yesterday's weather. We look back and say, well, we delivered in Scrum, we delivered this much, this many, here's our velocity. Now we have our velocity. What can we do next? It's based on yesterday's velocity. But we know if we're all of a sudden trying to bite off more, our velocity is going to decline. Our ability, our speed, velocity won't decline. The speed at which we get features delivered will decline. Think of a grocery store. When you stand at a grocery store, the checker doesn't ask each person, how long did you wait in line? 10 minutes? Oh, I better call a new checker. Right? They look back and they see a long line and they call a checker. They see their work in process and they add more capacity. Work in process is a leading metric. I'll beat it to death because I think it's important. You also want to manage your queues because those are a leading indicator of upcoming problems, WIP and queues. Let me do one more thought exercise, if I may. And I apologize, this is going to be a little bit more math. But it's not bad. And who do I pick on this time? What was your name?
Tom.
I have a Thomas and a Tom. I'll pick on you anyway, Tom. So, Tom, let's take a look at this. Here's Tom. Now, I'm going to give Tom something to do. I've got a water bottle. It doesn't matter what I need him to do, but I need him to unscrew the lid from this water bottle. And if I give Tom the water bottle and say, please unscrew the lid, go ahead, you can unscrew it. He didn't wait at all. I'm making a definition. He didn't wait at all. He just immediately got to work. He was unutilized. I'm making a definition of utilization. When I gave him the bottle, he could open it immediately. He was unutilized. Is that fair? Now I give him another bottle and say, can you open this one? And he says, I'll get to it as soon as I open this bottle or these 10 bottles. You're now utilized, Tom. So Tom is utilized when I come to him with work and he cannot do it immediately. That's my definition of utilization. Is that a fair definition? I'm going to define it very appropriately because we're going to get in some places here. Now, I don't want Tom to be unutilized all the time. So I'm going to give Tom a couple items to do, and I'm going to give him a new one and say, can you deliver this? And if his queue is very small, it doesn't take very long for him to get me that item. He's got to open two bottles before he opens mine. Okay? Fair enough? If, however, I give him a lot of work, and now I give him my bottle, it's a longer queue. You'll probably experience that tonight when you go and you're waiting in line for beer. Right? Lots of people in line for beer. When you get in line, it's going to take you a long time to get your beer. So that's a problem. But it's a trade-off we're making. Because Tom, I'm going to give Tom work at a rate. Here's a bottle. Here's another bottle. I'm giving him work at a particular rate. I'm going to call that rate M. And I'm calling it M so that you can look it up later. M is the common name for it. That's the rate at which Tom does his work. The rate at which I give Tom his work. Tom also has a rate at which he completes his work. Sometimes I give him a bottle every minute, sometimes every 30 seconds. Kind of random variables. And sometimes it's a really hard bottle to open and he's got to grab some pliers. And sometimes he opens it up in 10 seconds. So there's a variation here. There is one Tom. And the amount of work I'm going to give him can go to infinity. This is a theoretical example. It's called an MM1 infinity queue. And if you study queuing theory, this is a canonical queue that is well studied. And it looks like this. We have our lead time and we have our utilization rate across the bottom. And what's interesting is that the lead time changes with utilization dramatically. So if you have, remember utilization, if I go to you, Tom, and you have nothing to work on, and I give you a bottle and you rip open the bottle immediately, you are here at 0% utilization. If every single time I come to you, you're not working on anything. Now, let's say that 100% of the time that I come to you, you're working on something. That means you have a really big backlog of stuff to keep you busy. What does that do to your lead time? Under any type of variation here, as long as there's any randomness in here and any variation, the queue looks just like this. And it goes to infinity. When utilization goes to 100%, your lead time goes to infinity. So if you ask a manager at your company, how hard should we be working? How much utilization should we have? 110%. 98.5% is common. I want to talk about Microsoft versus Google for a minute. The old Microsoft. Not the way old Microsoft in Excel 3, but the one that was around maybe 5 years ago. 5 years ago, Microsoft's developers worked at very high rates of utilization. They had developers segregated from testers, segregated from operations, and you worked very high levels of utilization in each of those levels. Google took a slightly different approach. If you work for Google, they've changed this policy a little, but a year or two ago, if you worked for Google, you got one day every week to work on whatever you wanted. Your project. Gmail came out of that, Google Maps came out of that, a whole bunch of other products came out of it. But it's anything you want. Tom could work on his acoustic guitar simulator for the web, and Google would let him. So they've built in an 80% utilization rate. Now, the interesting thing is there's variation to what Tom is doing. So if it comes Friday morning and you're not done with your work Monday through Thursday, do you work on the acoustic guitar simulator or do you finish your work for Monday through Thursday and then Friday afternoon start your project? Thoughts? Friday afternoon, you start your project. They have built-in buffer. This is a business decision by Google. This isn't a, oh, this is nice for our employees. This is a business decision. Why? Because if you look at the lower utilization they have, but you look at the massively shortened lead time they have, what is important to Google? Delivering very, 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 very fast. That's what counts for Google. And it's so important that they're willing to drop their utilization to get more money or more work from their developers in order to achieve very fast cycle times. If any of you have heard Aaron Bjork talk or some of the other folks at Microsoft about their transition to Agile, you're going to hear implicitly this move to lower levels of utilization so that they can deliver very, very quickly. How fast does Visual Studio Online ship? Once every 3 weeks. That's a far cry from once every 2 or 3 years. Massively faster. Even TFS on-premises ships every 3 months, approximately. That's a massive change in their organization. So, use WIP limits to constrain queue size in order to get feedback faster. Don't overutilize your folks. Build Slack in to deliver faster. So there's two ways to get faster feedback. One, reduce your work in process. That shows up in Little's Law as being able to deliver much faster. Tip number one to get faster feedback, reduce your work in process. Tip number two to get faster feedback is implement a little bit of Slack into the system. When I walk to Tom to ask him to do something, approximately 5%, maybe 10%, maybe, like Google, 20% of the time, he'll say, yeah, I got nothing. I can take it. I can get right on it now. That can dramatically improve your ability to deliver faster. Now, for the business folks out there, does that mean that when they have low utilization, they're not doing anything? No. It just means that they're not building those features that go into the next release. Chances are they might be automating tests. They might be writing unit tests. They might be refactoring code. They might be doing those things that developers want to do but never have the time. Yes?
Just a comment, because I think it's a trade-off. When you remove some tasks from a work, you also take away his decisions regarding which task is the best to solve now.
What's your name? Henrik has a great comment. He says, now, if you take away the list of tasks a developer has to work on, you've taken away their ability to prioritize what they should work on now. Like, they may look at that and say, you know, I want to work on this one, and then I'll work on this one, and then this one. If they have a shorter list, they've got less flexibility, which means they probably are going to deliver less software because they can't optimize. They can't look at something low on the backlog priority and say, if I just coded that one at the same time as this high priority one, instead of taking 1 week and 1 week, I could do it in 8 days. Yes, true, but I would rather they did 1 week and 1 week so that I could get the feedback in 5 days rather than having to wait 8 days, even though I'd get feedback on both of those. Now, if they're really high close together, it's always a trade-off. Yes? Yes, you still have, the comment is, you still have a product backlog owner that's doing the prioritization and implementing this. And I think there are multiple levels, because even within a product backlog, you have tasks that developers really need to do, and they need to be able to manipulate in there, potentially. But I think it still stands, go faster on smaller chunks rather than more efficiently on bigger chunks, if you have to make a trade-off. Now, it is a trade-off, because if I go back to this slide, there's a cost, right? If I want really fast lead time, the cost of having everybody sitting on their bums doing nothing, waiting for work, is very, very high per feature. And the price goes down really low. By the way, how many of you have fire departments in your community? Probably most of you or all of you. If you have a fire department, you don't want them running at 100% utilization. You want them at very, very low levels of utilization. Let me give you one more example of that. There's a company, they're a giant company in Seattle that has a big website. It's not Amazon, it's another one, but another large company. And they have, I don't even know what they call them, super developers or whatnot. They're developers that do not get assigned any work. But if the website goes down, they can make changes in production. They don't have to go through QA. They don't have to go through a build environment. They can make changes directly in production. They're highly trained, highly skilled developers. They take their most skilled developers, and they take away all of their work. I swear they get special parking spots. They should wear special hats, but they don't. But they're very well respected. But what they do is they sit down and work with people and just pair program. So I'm going to sit down with Henrik here, and we're going to code together. And then when something happens and there's an emergency, Henrik's up and he's out. He just says, sorry, I can't work with you anymore. I got to do this. And he's out. But I can continue working. So he's spreading the knowledge. I think it's a really interesting approach. Okay. Here's an example of some of this. This is a company, and it's all going to be from the same company, same project. Here's some of their touch time versus lead time on their sprints. You'll notice their touch time is about 3 to 6% on here. They ran into this awful problem. This is just a visualization of their board. And notice here they have some design sign-off work, coding sign-off. So coders would build it. They'd wait in the sign-off queue for someone two levels higher than them to process it. It took a long time to get through these sign-off queues. And when they did sign off, it would jam in a whole bunch of stuff. This is the working ones. But the sign-off would come and just have a big mess in the coding queue. Then you had a massive amount of work in process, people calling, asking status, et cetera. A lot of stuff. We needed to get rid of this. But the people who did the sign-off were two levels higher than the team lead in the team. What we did is we put a cost of delay for all stories waiting sign-off. And we got that from the, basically, we guessed it. They had an ROI calculation that they did before. We guessed it. And we put this cost of delay on here. Now, the cost of delay, it was on all the columns, by the way. But the cost of delay, if I'm the boss walking by, I see that and go, wow, this week the cost to the company has been $21,000. And I'll say, Tom, what's that? And Tom will say, oh, don't worry about it. We know you're busy. This is just how much it costs for stuff to sit waiting your approval. That's going to very rapidly exceed my salary, right? So what happened? By just putting that in place, that metric, we got dramatically faster feedback. What happened is it just changed it because nothing would wait in this queue anymore. They said, how do we sign up for alerts? And we set them up with TFS alerts to let them know when something went into that state. You can see what happened over time from January to May. The hours of throughput, the length of time it took to get something through, dropped from 50-some-odd hours to 14, even though the amount of work that went into it stayed about constant. Not remarkably, the amount of bugs declined pretty dramatically, and multitasking reduced dramatically. That's the power of a single metric used appropriately. And I want to do one more thing, and it's looking at lead times. And to do that, I'm going to open up. This is a product that just shows off things from a development team. This is a real development team. You'll notice names have been anonymized. But here's a ship team. This is that cumulative flow diagram that we can look at how fast they're delivering. You can see they're totally a scrum team, right? If I get rid of looking at their backlog, it's this stair-stepped approach. Very much a stair-stepped approach. Now, if you look at their cycle times, this cycle time, you only get credit for a user story when it's done. And it only appears here when that user story is done. This is an interesting way to start understanding people's behavior. I'm measuring a time to feedback. The time to feedback I'm measuring is how quickly am I getting something done so that I can get feedback from it. But look what else I get. This is a Scrum team that's brand new. Look at this. Okay, evidently you can't touch this with that. If you look at the cadence on the Scrum team, they're delivering stuff to done at the very end of the sprint. What does that do to your testers? I'm just throwing this out here. This is just a balance, work balance thing, right? As a developer, we all pick up a bunch of work. We work until the end, and then we give it to the testers at the last day of the sprint and say, test this stuff so we can get it out to production. But look what happens to this Scrum team as they mature. This happens, by the way, open up any new Scrum team, this is the pattern. Right here, right up in the far right, notice how it's changed dramatically and it's not being delivered at the end of the sprint anymore, but stuff's being delivered early in the sprint. Why? Because developers look at the backlog, they say the high priority one's giant, we're going to grab the next high priority one, we're going to put 4 developers on it, and we'll deliver it today so that we can hand it to the testers early in the sprint and start to balance their workload. If it's hijunka, if you're in lean, right? You want to balance your work across. And if we look at that, we can even see that that's true. These are just metrics we can grab. If we get rid of new, closed, this is a finger chart, but let's get rid of, this is where the testers did their work, was in the resolved state. But look at this, big spikes at the end of sprints, and then a leveling out later on in the delivery. Why? We started to get feedback and understand it, and that's an example of what that might look like. Just one moment. Your turn for questions. We're coming up to the end, so just before questions, I want to do one thing. Here's the related content. Later on today, I'm going to be presenting Better Together using TFS and Visual Studio Online to increase agility. Not metrics related. But if you care about TFS or Visual Studio Online, it might make sense. And then here's a bunch of others that are coming as well that are related a little bit to these. They're in the related content. DevOps resources are here and available. And more DevTrack resources. And to do... Oh, don't forget this. How many of you have MSDN? How many of you are signed up to get your free Azure benefits? About 50%. Guys, there's a booth here. You sign up, you get 150 free dollars a month, or whatever the equivalent is, down to about $50 a month, or the equivalent in your currency, to spend that's free for you every month with your MSDN subscription. Activate it. Okay, now... we'll keep going to the eval and questions. Whew. Yes?
Can we take the questions offline?
It looks like we're done. Let's take questions offline. If you have questions, come on up, and I'll happily answer any questions that you have. Thank you very much.